This is episode 75 of The Variety Artist. This is John Abrams, that guy that interviews successful variety artists from around the world. I learned so much from this interview today. Michael's not only an amazing storyteller, but his recollection of the past is incredible. In this interview, you'll hear how Michael has used his God-given talents to change lives. From his involvement in the Black Panther Party to the importance of reading to working in correctional facilities, Michael is the man. His love for his art and what he's done with it is inspirational. Enjoy!
Fun fact number 378. John once licked an entire row of ants off a building pillar.
Welcome to The Variety Artist, providing aspiring artists and entertainers with in-depth discussions from top performers from all over the world. So get ready to book some gigs, make some money, and have some fun with your host, John Abrams.
He's one of the best storytellers in the country. His stories inform, educate, inspire, and amuse. He's traveled to Zimbabwe, India, China, Jamaica, and many more. His travels have reaped a harvest of tales that testify to the unity within the diversity of the human spirit. Variety artist, I give you Michael D. McCarty.
Ta-da!
What's going on, Michael?
You!
Me! No, you!
It's true.
All right, so people have a frame of reference of who I'm talking to here. What are you most famous for nationally or internationally?
Well, right now, it's my Skittles commercial. If you've seen a guy laughing and milking a giraffe, that would be me.
I've seen it a bunch of times, and I think I've messaged you a bunch of times that I've seen it.
Yes, it's on all over the place, constantly. I just saw it two or three times yesterday.
In fact, listeners, if you go on YouTube and you just search Skittles ad giraffe, you'll be able to see it there, and you'll be like, oh, yeah, yeah, okay, I know who that is.
Mm-hmm. Easiest audition I've ever did.
Oh, was it? Tell me about the audition.
Okay, so the job sheet read, Jamaican-style man, dreadlocks, and a big laugh.
Okay.
So when I walked into the studio, the guy before me was balder than Michael Jordan. He had one of those fake lock hats on, and they were like, get your butt out of here. And so I come in and they look and they say, well, at least your locks are real. Let's hear you laugh. And I nailed it. The eyes got big. A woman walking away turned around and just like, and the guy in the sound room stuck his head out and put a thumbs up. And the guy who was coming in after me, he just looked at me and said, oh, man.
Not that all sad. Well, in Southern California here, where you're from or where you live now, you're kind of known for your laugh.
Yes, it is true. Yes, it is true.
That was a piece of cake for you.
Oh, yeah.
Well, as long as we're talking about TV, you have a couple of specials that you did. One in called All Power to the People. Is that right? The Black Panther story?
Yep. Yeah, All Power to the People. I did that way back in the 90s. And then the most recent one, the Black Panther Party, Vanguard of the Revolution.
Now, what are those about?
They're both about the history of the Black Panther Party. The first one is a smaller documentary. The second one, it was a much bigger to-do. It got a lot of international play, and it's still being shown every year on PBS during Black History Month. It went into talking to people who had been in the party about their experiences in the party, their life after the party, and things of that nature.
All right, so for people that are under, let's say, 45, tell us, what is the Black Panther Party? Because some people, believe it or not, don't know what that is.
Well, there's a lot of people who don't know it, have a great many misconceptions. First and foremost, the Black Panther Party originally started in 1966 in Oakland, California, for the purpose of defending Black people against police brutality, and more specifically, people being shot and killed by police.
Okay.
And then it grew into a national and international organization, first as a a protection unit, then as a service organization, Breakfast for Children program, free medical clinics, free dental care, food, clothing giveaways, taking people to visit their friends and relatives in prisons when they didn't have transportation. It became about service to the people.
And how were you specifically involved in this?
I was in the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party, headquartered in Chicago. I was, for a time, the education lieutenant. My job was to teach the political education classes, in addition to doing other things that party members did in terms of the breakfast program and things of that nature. But my job was to teach the political education classes and to promote the reading lists, because the idea is you had to read. Mm-hmm. You had to read. You had to be aware of what was going on around you in order to make effective change and also to make people aware of what was happening around them.
So not only did you do that movie, but you also did more recently Belonging in the USA, Stories from Our Neighbors.
Yes. And the specific title is Belonging in the USA, The Story of Michael D. McCarty.
Oh.
By Arielle Nobilet, a young lady who I've known literally her entire life. Her parents are great friends of mine and house also have been a great influence on my life in a variety of ways. So when she saw all this hatred that was being spewed out over the last few years, she decided, as a filmmaker who would go into families and help them collect the stories of family members, that she wanted to do a documentary series about different people from different walks of life and how they deal with life. Mm. I got to tell you the story about her.
Please.
And our relationship. Like I said, I've known her and her entire life, and I saw her for about the first maybe 3, maybe 4 years of her life when I was living in Chicago. Then I left Chicago. The next time I saw her, she was about to graduate from high school.
Oh, my.
I'd gone over to visit her parents. Then the parents went to bed. It was me and her, one of her classmates. And I'm telling stories because that's all I've ever done.
Yeah.
And at some point, she says to me, Michael D., I really don't remember you. I said, of course, you were just a baby. I used to come over and I would play with you and I'd press your belly and go, boop, boop, boop. You remember that Simon game?
Yeah.
With the little lights and the sound.
Yeah.
They didn't have the game, but I would press her belly and go, boop, 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 till she was sick of me. All of a sudden, as I'm telling her this, her eyes get big as saucers, and all these memories start rushing in. She could describe me. She could describe the apartment, what was on the walls, the color of the carpeting.
Wow.
All these memories flushed in because of boop, boop, boop. Uh-huh. And so we've been close ever since.
So when she called you to do this special, you said, yeah?
Oh, yeah. And she did an amazing job. You can see the preview at belongingintheusa.com or at the Facebook page. You can see preview of my segment, and she's done two others since mine, and you can see the previews of those too.
I'm going to put those links on your show notes page. So someone just click on your show notes page and go right to them.
Great. Thank you.
Now let's get into your storytelling then.
Sure.
I guess one of the things I was thinking is in my intro, I mentioned that you traveled to Zimbabwe and India and China and Jamaica, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Do you create stories from adventures that you've had, or do you find a story and say, oh, I'd love to visit Zimbabwe because it's a great story coming from Zimbabwe? Or is it something different?
The answer is yes to both of those. Okay, let me get to Zimbabwe because it's very interesting you asked me that question. Mm. My first signature story is a story called The Strange Creature from Zimbabwe.
Okay.
And when I was doing this story, I didn't know how to pronounce Zimbabwe. And I said, I don't even remember what I said, but I said it wrong. And this sixth or seventh grade boy said, oh, no, it's Zimbabwe.
Oh.
And, and I was like, mm-hmm. I said, well, I'll show you. I'm going to go there.
Oh.
And in I think it was 1998, I was invited to do a speaking engagement in South Africa. And I did a side trip on my own to Zimbabwe, since that story was my signature story and I wanted to know more about that country and that culture.
Now, how about the other countries? Were those just travel related or related to stories?
Some of them were related. Well, ultimately, all of them are related to stories, because everything in my life becomes fodder for stories. But a lot of the things I've done, because I just love to travel. In 1982, I went to about a dozen countries. That was back when I was an acupuncturist. I went to Sri Lanka to take this acupuncture course.
So you traveled, so you traveled to Sri Lanka specifically for the acupuncture course?
Yes. In 1981, I graduated from Midwest Center for the Study of Oriental Medicine in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And I had trained at Lincoln Detox Clinic in New York in using acupuncture for drug detoxification.
Okay.
And in October of 1981, the director, Dr. Michael Smith, and one of the therapists, Jose Aponte, went to Sri Lanka for this acupuncture conference. Mm. And Dr. Smith asked me to come to New York and work in the clinic to take up the slack while he and Jose were gone.
Oh.
So when they came back, they told me these stories about Sri Lanka, which I had never heard of. And so I wanted to travel. So I said, okay, I'm going to go take this course. And said, oh, I want to go to India, and I got to go to China. And, oh, I might as well. I went to a dozen countries, Egypt, Morocco. It was just an amazing trip in India, and it changed the course of my life.
My daughter... Actually, both my daughters are travelers. My youngest daughter, the 21-year-old, she went to India, one other place, I forget, specifically to take yoga.
Oh.
Yeah, she went to Rishikesh specifically for yoga, and then traveled all around India, met some friends there, did all sorts of things. And then my oldest one went to school in England. So they're both travelers and world travelers, and they say the exact same things. They say, well, gosh, these are the things that changed my life.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I always tell people, when you travel, travel with an open mind and leave here, and go there and find there.
Mm-hmm.
So many, especially Americans, have a unfortunately well-deserved reputation for being lousy guests in other people's countries.
Mm.
Why did they do this? Why don't they do this? Why did I... Because they've been around for millennia.
Yeah, we've only been here for a little over 200 years. So, yeah, they've been there for thousands and thousands of years.
So I encourage people to, you know, try the food, learn something about the culture. And any place I go to, I'm not good with languages, but I learn how to say hello, goodbye, thank you, and where's the washroom?
There you go. All right, now let's talk, get into your storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
A little more. Do you have a goal in mind when you're starting a story, or do you have a goal in mind when you're putting a story together?
It depends. My selection, I do a wide variety of stories. I do folk tales, historical stories, and personal stories. With historical stories especially, I specialize in African and African-American history and culture, because that's part of my mission. To make these stories aware, not only to the Black community, but especially to the Black community, but to the world as a whole, because there are so many stories from African and African-American culture that aren't known.
Mm.
People know about slavery. They know about Harriet Tubman and George Washington Carver and Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
But there's so much. The richest man in history, Mansa Musa, who was the emperor of Mali. Who had a pilgrimage to Mecca. It ruined the economy of several countries because he gave away pounds and pounds of gold all along his trip.
Mm.
The story of Eugene Jock Bullard, the first African-American military pilot who flew for France in World War I. He received medals, every medal from France, and then in World War II, he was a spy. But people don't know about him. So I search out these stories, these little known or almost unknown stories, and I bring them to life.
Okay.
I love it. And then with I tell stories from different cultures because stories travel. Stories historically, for instance, there's a story called The Monkey and the Crocodile. Mm-hmm. It's a classic story that I first came across in India as it's one of the Jataka tales. And that was before I became a professional storyteller. When I became a storyteller, I found a version of it in East Africa, and I found versions of the story in China and Japan where the crocodile had become a dragon. Hmm. So stories, we see these things that we have in common through our stories, and at the same time, we see the things that make each culture, each country different and unique.
I read in the paperwork that you have a passion for literacy. And is that the reason? Is because of your original workings with the Black Panther Party?
Part of it, but even more than that is my mom.
Oh.
My mom, I can remember my mom reading and telling me stories when I was 2-3 years old. And she was from Barbados, and she always talked about the importance of reading. Time and time again, she would say to me, if you can read, you can do anything. Mm-hmm. And she encouraged me to read. She bought me books. She bought me comic books. She inadvertently turned me on to Marvel comic books. One day she was going downtown Chicago to pick something up, and I wasn't going with her. She said, you want anything? I said, yeah, some comic books. And she came back, not with Superman or Batman or Justice League. She came back with Fantastic Four and Doctor Strange. And I said, what? This is, Spider-Man. But the thing is that she said, reading will get you anywhere and everywhere. And that was the beginning of it for me. Mm. Then with the Black Panther Party, we also had schools that we would set up in various communities. Once I became a storyteller and I came across so many kids, I worked in continuation schools, and so many of these kids either didn't know how to read or write, or read or write really, really poorly. Mm-hmm. Really, really poorly. So I saw the importance of it. I met this guy, all of a sudden his name eludes me, but the book was called The Teacher Who Couldn't Read. Mm-hmm. Johnny Corcoran, not Cochran, Corcoran, Johnny Corcoran.
Okay.
This guy was a teacher, taught in high school for, I think, almost 20 years, couldn't read.
Oh.
He developed all these techniques to hide the fact that he couldn't read. He got awards for his innovative teaching style.
Hmm.
And all of it was to hide the fact that he couldn't read. He got busted by his, I think, 3-year-old daughter. He and a wife would read her books, storybooks.
Yeah.
One day the daughter asked him to read a book that the mother usually read. And what he would always do with the books that he read was look at the pictures and make up a story to go along with the pictures.
Mm-hmm.
When he started to do this with this book that the mother usually read, the little girl was saying, no, daddy, that's not right. No, daddy, that's not the way the story. And his wife was there. He had told his wife that he couldn't read, but she didn't understand. She thought he didn't like to read. And that was the motivation. And I think he was in his late 40s at the time to learn to read. And he went on to learn how to read and write.
Yeah, my brother, believe it or not, couldn't read until more recently. And he is in construction. So he was trying to get, what is the license, the contractor's license?
Yes.
He went to get his contractor's license and he couldn't read the test. So he did the test with somebody who could read next to him, and they made accommodations for him that this person could read the questions and he would answer the answers.
Ah.
But he couldn't read it. And I think that held him back for years and years and years until he was 40, 45 years old.
Amazing.
Yeah, he finally figured out a way to do it. We have a neighbor. I know I'm going on and on about this reading thing, but
important.
Yeah, we have a neighbor that when she was, I think we met her when she was maybe 7 years old. And we were reading Dr. Seuss and, you know, different kids' books. And we realized when she went to read one that she couldn't read almost at all. She couldn't read the words cat or dog. And so we ended up teaching her on a weekly basis. We got hooked on phonics. I'm sure you've seen that.
Yep.
It's a way of teaching people to read. And we actually helped her to teach her to read. And a couple years later, she was reading like a champ.
It's important. So one of the things that I do is I give away books.
Mm.
I started doing this. I've been a professional storyteller since 92. One of the early jobs I had was working in the Boys and Girls Clubs in Long Beach doing a storytelling workshop series. And the way I did it is, if you told a story, you got a book. You tell a story, you get a book.
Okay.
So I was at one of the clubs and they had a little basketball team at the Boys and Girls Club. And the director of the clubs made it a requirement that the team members had to come to my class.
Mm.
And they were not happy.
Not at first.
So they're sitting there with their arms crossed. And I said, oh, you want a book? No, I don't want a book. I don't want no book. So the next class, I had books about Michael Jordan, Shaquille O'Neal,
Kobe
Bryant. And I put out 2, 3, maybe 4 of those books. I'd have 20-odd books out. And needless to say, those books went first. Well, then they had to get something else. And slowly, slowly, they started getting other kind of books and reading other kinds of books.
Mm. I'm
like that.
That's great. I have to read this. It says, listen carefully. Over the past few years, Michael has supported efforts to increase literacy by buying large amounts of books, which he then gives to young people at his storytelling events. Recently, Michael organized a bus trip for young people, and one of the stops was Esowan, which is a bookshop.
Yep.
On this trip, what is it called?
Esowan,
okay. On this trip, each of the kids were given a gift certificate. Michael allowed them to pick what they wanted, and if the gift certificate was not enough to cover it, he paid for the difference. We have seen Michael purchase books many times like this, and it is encouraging to see that someone cares enough to help others. And that was James, is it Fugat? I don't know. He's the president of Esowan Books.
Yeah, he and Tom are the founders of Esowan.
Okay.
So every kid got a gift certificate because I wanted them to have the experience of buying their own books. Because usually kids, they're with their parents, and it's mama, can I have this? Or daddy, can I get this? But now here they are. They have the gift certificate. They could pick the book that they wanted to pick.
Mm.
And I wanted them to have that experience because for me, books are transformative. They're fun. They're engaging. They allow you to see through others' eyes. And I always say when people talk about trying to get someone to read, find out what they like. Whatever it is, that I had a kid one time, I was at a Whole Foods coming out and I saw this teenager. I have books in my car that I give away. And I said, what do you like to read? He says, I don't like to read. I said, okay. I said, you like rap? He said, yeah. I said, I got a book about 50 Cent. I got a book about Tupac. Oh, yeah. Or I have Marvel comic books. One time I was at a continuation program, school program over on Crenshaw, and I had given most of the kids books, but there were a couple of boys, and it's usually always the boys, I don't want to read no book.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I got some Marvel comic books. Okay. So I gave Marvel comic books, and then I had this physics set. It was a workbook, a textbook, and a workbook. There was this one kid, one boy sitting by himself, and all the rest of the kids were in another part of the room. And I just sort of said to Noble One in particular, anybody interested in reading about physics?
Mm-hmm.
And he looks at me, then he looks to see that the kids aren't looking, and he gives me the nod. So I slip him the books.
And he ended up using them?
I believe so. And here, I'm glad you asked me that question at that time. I give away books, and that's it. I plant the seed. Sometimes it's some of my neighbor's kids, and I'm not always asking them, did you read the book? Wah, da, 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 da. But I'll offer them other books because I'm not trying to pressure them. I'm planting the seed and then stepping away from it. But I got to tell you this. So this, because this had to do with one of my neighbors. One of my neighbor's son was by to visit, and he was with his girlfriend and the girlfriend's daughter, who was about maybe 12 or 13, and this boy, who was a cousin, I think, maybe a year or two younger than the girl. So I have all these books in my parking space. So I said, oh, come on over here. And I told them, you know, have some books. Like I said, they could each get like 2, 3, 4 books. Mm-hmm. So it was a year or two later, and I saw my neighbor's son. I said, hey, how you doing? Oh, what happened to the boy? Because I'd seen the girl at some point, but I hadn't seen the boy. He said, oh, I've been meaning to tell you. Before that day, he didn't read. He got poor grades in school. Since those books he got that day, his grades have gone up. Not only is he getting good grades and is he reading and writing, but he makes his own books. He also draws. He makes his own comic books. Wow. And draws and writes the stories.
Wow.
All because of have a book.
Have you seen that a lot? Have you,
yes.
Have you gone back and run into people later?
Yes.
And are there other stories that I should know about?
There are billions of them. Because I've, back with that Boys and Girls Club, I remember I did that program in Long Beach for about 9 or 10 years. In the 9th or 10th year, and I was at the club that I started at, and I ran into this kid who was, when I first encountered him, he was maybe in 4th grade. Now he was in high school. Mm-hmm. And I said, hey, he said, hey, bookman, you're the storyteller, the bookman. I said, hey, you still read? He said, yes. I said, come on. And I took him to the car, let him get some more books.
The bookman.
Yeah, I love it.
All right, so let's switch gears a little bit. Let's talk about your teaching storytelling in prisons.
Yes.
You do a lot of teaching in prisons. Tell me about, how did you get involved in that?
Well, as mentioned, I became a professional storyteller in 1992. And at the time, there was a program, Arts and Corrections, going on in California prisons. Every California prison had an arts director. And a friend of mine named Zoot was a part of that program, first as an artist and then as an administrator. And he told me about the program when I met him, but at the time it wasn't anything that I was ready for. The Arts and Corrections program died in the early 2000s. It got its funding cut. Mm-hmm. In 2014, the Arts and Corrections program was resuscitated. And I got contacted by Zoot, who was working for the Muckenthaler Cultural Center, and Quetzal Flores, who was working for Alliance for California's Traditional Arts. Each of them asked me if I wanted to go to prison.
Wait, hold on a minute.
And so they asked me to teach storytelling. I was like, yes, I can't wait. Mm-hmm. So I have been doing this program. I'm going into my 6th year doing it. Been in 11, it will soon be 12 different prisons. And what I teach is a story creation workshop. I show them how to find, develop, and tell their stories. Now, the overall concept of the Arts and Corrections is that inmates who participate in the Arts and Corrections program, while they're in prison, they're less likely to be involved in any mischief. And when they get out, they're more likely to stay out.
Oh.
All right, so that's Arts and Career, and there are people, the Actors Gang, Tim Robbins Actors Gang, there's Shakespeare in prisons, there's people teaching all kinds of music, guitar, African drumming, all kinds of drawing of all kinds, murals and what have you. Huh. Right now, inmates who participate in the program successfully, they get a reduction in their sentence.
Oh. Oh.
But more importantly, and this is especially regarding storytelling, when they go before the parole board, they have to be able to tell their stories. When they get out and go for a job interview, they have to be able to tell their stories.
Mm-hmm.
I've been doing this long enough, I'm seeing some of my guys get out. And one of the guys I was talking to recently, he said he was going for job interviews. He was being very technical about, you know, his ability to do whatever the job was. And somebody said to him, well, we don't know your story. And that's the important thing. They have to be able to tell a story because, okay, let me tell you this story.
Okay.
There's this program, as I mentioned, Shakespeare in Prisons. It's a worldwide organization. And last year, I went to a conference they had in San Diego. And there were a group of returning citizens, people who had been in prison. And one of the guys from New York shared this story. So he's at Rikers. He's in prison. He had gotten his bachelor's degree, and he was getting ready to go for the parole board. And he was thinking that having gotten his bachelor's degree, that was going to carry some weight in terms of him possibly getting out. Well, his butt wasn't even in the seat good before they shot that sucker down.
Oh, yeah.
So it's going on, and they're just like shooting everything down. And he's thinking, man, I'm not going to get a break. And then one of the panelists said to him, so, tell us about Shakespeare. Because he had started a Shakespeare club in the prison. And so a discussion ensued on Shakespeare. At one point, he was asked a question by one of the panelists about some aspect of Shakespeare. He gave his answer. Another panelist said, well, I don't know if I agree with that. And the discussion went on further. He got a Shakespearean discharge, okay? Because in telling that story, because they're trying to find out about who you are now as opposed to who you were when you came into the prison.
Right.
And if you just say, I took this class, I did this, I did that, that doesn't say anything. A whole bunch of people have taken classes. What's the story? What did those classes mean to you? Why did you take them? What did you learn? Da, da, da. That discussion on Shakespeare helped him.
Yeah, and how did those classes change your life? Wow.
I tell you something, John, it's been amazing to me because I knew nothing about prisons when I went into the program. In fact, my first day, I would say, the only thing I know about prison is the Shawshank Redemption.
That's right. Tell us about your first experience with that.
Oh, man. Because
I'm sure you have all sorts of preconceived ideas of what was going to go on.
But more importantly is they either had preconceived ideas or not a clue about who I was and storytelling. That's a kid's thing. Why do we need that? So when I first went in, first thing I did is I made that little joke about the Shawshank.
Mm-hmm.
And then I talked about the importance of storytelling. You had asked me about a book that I recommend, and there's a book that I always recommend to people. I don't care what they're doing in life. It's called The Story Factor by Annette Simmons. And The Story Factor, she talks about there are six stories of influence or six stories everybody needs to be able to tell. Who am I? Why am I here? The vision, the teaching story, the values and action story, and the I know what you're thinking story. Now, that I know what you're thinking story is especially important for people who have been in prison or jail.
Mm-hmm.
Because when somebody finds out you've been in prison or jail, well, they saw a Red Orange Is the New Black, they saw Shawshank. So they know, they think they know about you. It's important. In fact, it is essential that in their stories, they have to address that. All right. So you're sitting across the panelists. You're sitting across the guy who's going to maybe hire you or not hire you for this job.
Yeah.
And you have to understand that they're looking at you thinking, he been in prison. Right. Even if they don't know why you've been in prison, it doesn't matter because all the stereotypes come up in their mind. You've got to address that.
Mm.
You've got to talk about how you're going to prison, you're being in prison, what you learned, how you grew, how you have changed from that person that went into prison to that person who was about to get out of prison.
Mm.
All right. And if you don't address those questions that the people have in their minds, I don't care what you say. I don't care how many things you've done, because facts without a story will not mean what you think it should mean or what you want it to mean.
Right.
You have to give the story. You have to give the facts, the information within the context of a story. Okay, tell you this one. These are two little stories.
Go.
Had a guy, I was at High Desert Prison up near Reno, which is one of the prisons where all the other California prisons send their hard cases. And this guy's in my class. It's the first day. He's been in prison 30 years. He had just come from his parole board hearing. And he said, Mike, I know how to talk, but I was so nervous. I kept messing up. And they stopped me. They said, you're not ready. Come back in 10 years. Okay. The following week, I was at another prison. And another one of my guys says, I've got my parole hearing coming up next week. I said, you ready for it? He said, oh, yeah. The next week I saw him, I said, how'd it go? He said, I used 16 of the stories that I developed in your workshop in my hearing. And at one point during the hearing, one of the panelists asked him a question, and he said, I have a story that will answer that question. And all three panelists leaned forward and said, all right, let's hear it.
Yeah.
It's in our DNA.
Yeah.
Storytelling, I like to say, is the oldest form of mass communication. And before there was anything written, we told stories. We told stories when we had language, which we told stories. Before we had language, we drew or pantomimed. But story is, we are made up of stories.
Yeah. Well, I've interviewed a lot of different people on this podcast, and almost every single person that I've interviewed has talked about putting stories in your particular art, whatever it may be. Even if it's not specifically storytelling, if it's juggling or magic or hula hoop or whatever it may be, if you can put stories in your art, that's the way to go to make it more interesting.
There was a soul singer out of Chicago, Lou Rawls.
Yeah.
And Lou Rawls, before he went into his songs, he would very often tell stories.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason was he was performing in nightclubs and bars where people are drunk or trying to get drunk or they're hitting on somebody and what have you. And he found that if he just started singing, nobody really paid attention to him. But if he started telling a story first, people would stop and they would listen.
Mm.
And then they would listen to his song.
So talk us through the process of when you go to visit a prison. How does that work?
So first thing you have to do, in most prisons, you have to go through the gate. The first gate is a guard shack where they just check your ID. Then when you go on the prison grounds, they know you're coming. And so you have to show your ID. For me, I bring in a variety of things, including my story bag, which is a bag full of all kinds of strange and wacky stuff. I got winged pigs and cows. I got skulls. I got toy rats. I got a book with a bookworm in it. So then they have to go. And it's funny because when I come through, they have to go through every one of these items. And I have over 30 items in my story bag. And so people are looking at like, oh, my God, what is that?
You have a winged pig. Why do you have a winged pig? Oh, my goodness.
And the idea is that they reach in the bag, they pull something out, and they tell a story that involves that thing.
Mm.
So you go through that, and then you go to whatever yard you're going to be on. Usually the yards are A, B, C, or D primarily. There are a couple of exceptions in some of the other prisons, especially there's a yard where people are about to get out. So you're going to be at one or more of these yards, and so you go and you get get your room set up, and then your students come who have signed up for the class, or in some cases, somebody signed them up for the class.
You can tell who those are when they walk in, probably.
Oh, yeah. They're looking like, what the heck is this? I didn't sign up for that. It's like I had one guy, he said he was trying to get into some other kind of class. I think it was a writing class. And I guess he kept bugging them, and they put him in my storytelling class.
Yeah.
And so he comes in the first day, and he's storytelling. I'm a writer. I'm not a storyteller. And he planned to leave. Not only did he not leave, not only did he finish my class, he's been in my class a total of 3 times.
I would think that would help his writing, right?
Yes. Yes. And once they realize that all this, the stuff that I do, it seems wild and crazy, which it is, but it all has a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going into my 6th year at this one prison, and I've got one guy who's been in my class almost all of those years. Even when he wasn't officially in my class, he would drop by. And one time I have a little introduction that I do for on the first day. One day, 3 of my former guys were walking by. They saw, they came in, they did my introduction for me.
Ladies and gentlemen, Michael D.
But I tell you, it's been amazing, because guys have told me that it's easier for them to engage with their families, especially their kids, once they can tell stories.
Mm-hmm.
They can talk story.
Yeah.
And that makes their lives a little bit easier.
The setting that you're talking about, is it just you and your students, or are there other people there?
A good question. For the most part, it's me and my students.
Okay.
All right, for the most part. Some prisons, there were, when I was at Corcoran. Corcoran is one of the rougher prisons in the system. That's where Manson was.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was, that was a level 4. Now prison yards are level 1 through 4, 4 being the roughest. Level 4 yards are the closest to the stereotype that you see on movies and in TV.
Yeah.
They tend to be divided, well, they're divided by race, and then within race by gang. And those can be rough. So when I was at that prison, we had 2 officers. There was 1 officer on the floor, and there was another officer in the cage above the floor with a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, at this point, I don't have anybody. I don't have an officer with me. It's me and my students.
Has any crazy things happened?
No, not crazy bad stuff.
That's what I mean.
A lot of crazy silly, but no.
Yeah, a lot of fun silly things.
Yeah, it's quite amazing, because all of a sudden guys are, the way I teach storytelling is I show them how to mine their mind for their stories.
Hmm.
So I've developed, there are some exercises that I've developed specifically for the work that I do in the prisons. And what happens is that all of a sudden guys are drawing out stories, coming up with stuff they had forgotten about. Some of it is intense, some of it is funny, but the most important thing is that it's their stories. Hmm. And I show them how to capture them, not just in that moment, but I show them a technique so that as they're going on through their life and they remember things, there's a way to catch them and keep those stories.
Well, now, how can somebody get involved in this if they want to? Is there a person they can call, a website they can go on?
Well, yeah, actually, the program is called Arts and Corrections. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of different organizations. Probably the easiest thing is to contact me. And then I can put them in contact, depending on where they are in the state, because there are 35 prisons up and down the state. So depending on where they are, I can connect them with an organization that goes into a prison system that is, I'll say, close to them. Now, I drive sometimes. Right now, most of my longest drives are 4, maybe 5 hours.
Mm.
When I went to High Desert, that's a 10-hour drive.
Yeah.
Or I would go up there and I would stay for 2 weeks.
Okay.
But there are programs in, like, say, every one of the California state prisons, and they contact me. I'll get them in contact with one of the agencies that is in whichever prison is closest to them.
Perfect. And what we'll do is I'll get all your information at the end of this interview. It'll be awesome.
Cool.
And they just contact you. All right, we're going to go into some fan questions. You want some fan questions there, Michael D?
Bring them on.
All right. The first one is from Katia Lopez.
Ah.
Yeah, you know Katia?
Oh, yes.
She's a snake charmer, belly dancer, and all-around amazing entertainer.
Mm-hmm.
Ask him when his vegetarian adventure began.
Very good story.
Mm.
It was probably 1975. I was in the Army stationed in Korea. And as I mentioned, I'm a readaholic, and I was reading this magazine, Circus Circus. I don't know if it's still being published, but it's a rock magazine, music magazine. And there were articles about Earth, Wind, and Fire and the rock group Yes. And it mentioned that most of the members of those groups were vegetarian. And mm-hmm. I'd never heard of such a thing. So I started experimenting. I'd say, okay, tomorrow I'm not going to eat any meat, or this week I'm not going to eat any meat. And then when I got out, I stopped eating pork. I got out in December of 75 and stopped eating pork. 77, 4th of July, 1977, a girlfriend and I over at my buddy Herb's a 4th of July party. And she said, after today, let's stop eating red meat. I said, okay.
All right.
And just stopped eating it. 79, I lost my taste for fowl, just stopped eating it. 1982, my first trip to India, I stopped eating fish. Yeah. And I've been a vegetarian ever since.
Wow. And you're feeling great?
I feel great.
You look great.
Yeah, and I love to cook. So and most of the people I cook for are not nobody in my family is vegetarian. Most of my friends are not vegetarian, but they love my food because I'm good like that.
Yeah, one of the misconceptions about vegans and vegetarians is that the food is bland. There's so many amazing things that vegetarians could cook. I imagine you included.
I'd make vegetarian jambalaya.
Mm.
My wife and I just celebrated our 20th wedding anniversary.
Happy anniversary, by the way.
Thank you very much. And we had some people over, and I made my jambalaya, barbecue tofu, and greens. And if I don't tell people my jambalaya is vegetarian, they don't know.
Oh, man, that sounds good. Where was my invitation? All right, on that, we'll go to next fan question. Pete Ellison.
Yay.
Founder of Show Ops, or Show Operations, the top CRM in the biz, and a musician and founder of One World Rhythm, says, Michael's energy and enthusiasm both on and off stage are contagious, as you can see from this interview. When did you know in your heart that storytelling was your thing?
Well, that goes back to this point where, first story, okay. 1991, I was at this vegetarian, in fact, vegan restaurant, and a friend of mine asked the owner of the restaurant how he got into the restaurant business after finding out he had gone to school to be an architect. He said he read something in this book, What Color Is Your Parachute? Book about careers. Mm-hmm. You should make a list of 10 things that you like to do on a day-to-day basis and then see how you can make a living doing some combination of those 10 things.
Hmm.
I said, that's a great idea. Give me a piece of paper. And I made my list. Like to read, like to write, like to travel, like to tell stories, like to make people laugh. 92, I would become a professional storyteller. 93, 94, I'm going through my files. I run across that list of the 10 things on that list. All of them just about I do as a storyteller. It's just been an amazing adventure because once I discovered, I met this guy, Joel Ben Izzy, who was introducing me as a professional storyteller. I said, you do what? People pay you to tell stories?
You're like, yeah.
And then I said I was going to do it. My motto was going to be Have Mouth, Will Run It, which is my website.
Yep.
And I went to my local library in Echo Park. I was getting books about storytelling. This librarian, Anthony Bernier, asked me why I was getting all these books, asked if I was writing a paper. I said, I'm a storyteller. He said, you're a storyteller? I got these teenagers. They want to learn storytelling. Can you give them a workshop? And I said, sure.
Mm.
Because my mother told me if I could read, I could do anything, and I can read my butt off.
Yeah.
I gave the workshop, became a resource for the L.A. library system and then the surrounding systems, and been running my mouth around the country and around the world ever since.
Yeah, you and I have a similar story about the library thing. When I first ever did a library show, it's because I used to go to the Gardena Library and check out books on magic. After I had checked out a bunch of books on magic, one of the magicians that was performing at the Gardena Library was sick. And so the librarian came to me and said, oh, can you perform? I see you're checking all these magic books. Can you perform a show next, whatever it was, next Wednesday? I said, yes, I can. The rest is history.
Yeah, you got to be crazy and believe in yourself.
That's it. And you, and when that is offered, you got to jump in.
Okay. Now, I'm glad you mentioned that. One of the things, I teach this in my classes in the prisons. That's how it started. There's this movie, Hidden Figures.
Oh, yeah.
About the black women who were involved in the space program.
Yep. Wonderful movie.
Oh, yeah. But there's two scenes that I reference in terms of what you just said. The first scene is in the very beginning of the movie when she's a little girl and she's in this eighth grade class. She looks like she needs to be in fourth grade. Her feet are dangling off the chair. She can't even touch the floor. And the teacher comes up to her and says, Catherine, why don't you show us how to solve this quadratic equation? Mm-hmm. And she took the chalk. I call it a seize the chalk moment. And she went up there and did it. And I love the scene where the teacher and the other students all looking like, huh? How'd she do that? This is so little. Yeah. And then later in the movie, when they're trying to get John Glenn down, again, Kevin Costner playing her boss holds out the chalk and says, Catherine, why don't you show them what you found? And I call that seize the chalk moments. What you did when you said yes, what I did when I said yes.
Yep.
Those were seize the chalk moments. Now, there are people who will balk. They'll say, oh, I'm not ready. And they're probably not, and they probably never will be. Mm-hmm. You and those seize the chalk moments come, you got to grab them. And they will very often define the success of your career.
And the truth is, sometimes you're not ready for that. You may not have been ready to teach that class. I may not have been ready to do that magic show. But you know what? Next Wednesday, I was ready.
Yep. There you go. I'm going to get ready.
Yeah. There's something about having a deadline.
Yep.
Oh, by the way, Alicia Walker asked the same question.
Oh.
There you go, Alicia.
Yay.
Is that a blast from the past?
Yeah, we go way back.
Well, there you go. A little shout out to Alicia Walker.
Yay.
All right. So next one, Brett Bolich, an amazing magician out of SoCal, asks, how do you keep your energy up?
It helps to be crazy. It also helps to love what you do. I tell you, for instance, I drive a lot working in these prisons. But the Sunday prison I go to, I'm on the road. I'm up at 2:30 a.m. on the road by 3:30 a.m. for a four-hour drive to Valley State Prison and then do my workshops there and then drive to California City, spend the night and do workshops there and then drive out to Blythe for a couple of prisons I work in out there. But I love what I do. And the drive doesn't matter because I get to do something which is what I'm here to do and has an impact on the lives of people.
I think we'll end there. I've taken enough of your time, man. I have all sorts of other things, but you know what? If someone really wants, they can see, if someone really wants to know more about you, they need to watch your film.
Yes.
Watch some of the Black Panther stuff. If they're interested in getting involved in the prisons.
Contact me.
How can someone get a hold of you? Or do you have some sort of social media you want to plug here?
I'm on Facebook. Friend me on Facebook. I have a personal page. I have a professional page. I may pay more attention to the personal page. So friend me. Check out my pages. They're public. Post my phone numbers, my landline, my cell line, my email. If you have a question, if I can be of help, let me know. And I'll give you a book. Especially if you're interested in storytelling, but whatever you're interested in, I'll give you a book. That's what I do.
That's a deal. I'll put all your contact information on your show notes page.
Great.
That was awesome. You're so great, Michael.
Well, John, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for doing my show. It's been a pleasure, my friend.
Well, this has been great. And like I said, I'm off to Chicago for a couple of weeks, and then I start back in the prisons. But at some point, we're going to do lunch.
I think we should do that. We should definitely do that.
All right, John. Have a great one.
Thank you so much. If you want to get involved in the Arts and Corrections program, contact Michael directly. I put his info along with the Belonging in the USA link on Michael's show notes page. Just go to thevarietyartist.com and search McCarty. That's McCarty, and you'll find it there. You can reach me at my Facebook page. Just shoot me out a message. While you're there, join my Facebook group at The Variety Artist, where you can ask me to ask questions of our guests and join in with Free for All Fridays and Marketing Mondays. Now go out and book those gigs, make some money, and have some fun.
That's all for this episode of The Variety Artist, but your journey continues on our website. Go to thevarietyartist.com for more strategies, insight, and resources, as well as show notes on today's guest to assist you in your career. We'll see you on the next episode of The Variety Artist. But until then, go out and book those gigs, make some money, and have some fun.